answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
So, sorry, Sheikh, what about reading an ayah to the water that we are drinking or the food? For example, before starting drinking water or eating a food, for example, we started saying some invocations, religious formulas, in order to get more blessing from that food. Is it true?
You know, if we say that it has some effects on the water, uh-huh. You know, the ayat of the Quran.
Yes. Okay.
That is something that we can say is true, you know, mm-hmm. because the Holy Quran has the ayat of the Holy Quran might have this kind of, let's say, effect. On the water.
Yes.
But the point is that can we expect from that water, for example, to cure the illness, uh-huh. you know, the sickness, or to seek, for example, refuge to that water? I think that we cannot find like authentic hadith or let's say justification from the Islamic perspective that whether it is true to believe in such kind of things. I'm not.
But for example, Bismillah before eating, or for example, Shukran Lillah at the end of, we can say, for example, the food and drinking or something. Or saying salam to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, these has their own effects, isn't it?
So salam to Imam Hussein is okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah? We have to say salam to Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam. That's okay. But no, if you believe that this water will solve your problem, will cure your illness, do we have any, let's say, is it something religiously or from the Sharia perspective? Is it something that we can find some authentic, let's say, justification for it? And the ayat in riwayat? No, there's no such a thing, you know?
You know, there was a Japanese scientist by the name of Masaru Emoto. Mm-hmm. He was the, we can say, molecule, that's right, scientists who studied the effects of different sounds of the molecules of water. So one of them was, for example, reciting out the text of the Holy Quran to the molecules of water and how the molecules will react to the sound that they hear. Upon, for example, recitation of the Quran, the shape of the molecules was in their most beautiful parts, which is, for example, intact, you know. It is not like, for example, rock music when you play for someone, you know, it will be somehow agitated inside or agitated in the molecule. So we could see that the sounds and the science of the sound and the, we can say, audiography, the sounds have direct effect on the world around. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's why if we bless our day or bless our food or water or the recitation of the ayah of the Quran or something like that, it will give us more spiritual perfection and growth, isn't it, Sheikh?
As I told you, it would have a kind of effect on the molecules of the water, you know?
Yes.
There's no doubt about which. But the point is that do we have any ayah, you know, any riwayah, any hadith, saying that, for example, if you read some ayat of the Quran on the water, then it will cure, you know, your sickness, your illness. There's no such thing, you know.
Yes.
Of course, it is good to read sometimes the holy ayat of the Holy Quran before, for example, drinking water, you know.
Yes.
There's no problem with that. But the point is that you should not believe in this, that this water will cure the illness. We do not have such a thing in riwayat, you know?
So everything is in the hands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We need the power.
Yes.
And the realm of the power of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the problems might be solved. But, Shaykh, we know that there's so many people who have been, for example, healed during the history of Islam. For example, Jesus Christ himself was a healer, isn't it? Mm. So the Ayyamas did so, or Prophet Muhammad himself did so. So by the order of Allah and by the power of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, such people exist. I mean,
of course, you know, the miracles of the prophets, that is something exceptional, you know. Yes. We cannot generalize it for all the people. Yeah, Prophet Isa, for example, could blow into the piece of clay and make it like bird. Can we say that everybody could do that? No, of course not, you know. Or, for example, A'imma sometimes made some du'as, specific du'as, prayers. They had this power, but we cannot generalize it for the ordinary people, saying that it's allowed for all the people to blow in the clay. Nothing will happen, you know. That's that's the reality.
Yes, and we must say that we must not lose our logic or rationality in such cases, because logic and rationality is also emphasized by the religion of Islam, isn't it? For example, to lose your mind and just follow out your feelings, and we can't say get nowhere. That's all right. Okay, we got about two more minutes. Let me ask the final question regarding this part. So what religious formula do you recommend the people in order to start, for example, their eating and drinking or the finish according to Islam? Do we have any aqaid, a special aqaid on this?
You know, in the lifestyle of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, we have that when the Prophet was drinking or wanted to drink, for example, a glass of water, a cup of water.
Yes.
First of all, Prophet drank it in, for example, three times, not once.
Yes.
This is very good to
do that. In three, for example, intervals.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
And then he would always praise the Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala before drinking, after drink.
Yes.
He did not drink water while standing.
Okay.
For example, you know. Sometimes we have these kind of things in the lifestyle of the Holy Prophet that when it comes to drinking water, we can apply these sort of things. Or when it comes to the Holy Quran, why don't we read the Holy Quran for being healed, for being created, the Holy Quran itself.
Yes.
You know, because the ayat of the Holy Quran, for example, for Surah Al-Hamd.
Yes.
We have this in riwayat that if you put your right hand on your heart and recite, directing yourself towards Qibla with wudu.
Yes.
And then write, for example, seven times Surah Al-Hamd.
Yes.
On your heart.
Yes.
Then it will, for example, help you a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, this sort of things we have when it comes to the riwayat.
That's all right. Yes. Okay. Thank you very much, Shaykh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding this topic. It was very kind of you.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. We again do supplicate to Allah to hasten the reappearance of Imam Asr, Ajalallah, Inshallah. Fi amanallah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
It must be heaven.
Part 3.
The 60s was a decade of the great rebellion of European filmmakers against Hollywood. Jean-Luc Godard, as the most famous filmmaker of the New Wave in France, was at the forefront of all the rebellions that targeted the capitalist system and the Hollywood studio system. In 1968, Godard, the most revolutionary anti-Hollywood filmmaker, went to Jordan. He visited the Palestinian camps, met Abu Ali, Hani, Johariya, and their friends, and filmed the refugee camps and guerrilla bases. He used the videos in a movie titled Here and Elsewhere. In the same year, the U.S. proposed a peace plan to the conflicting parties in the Middle East. The Palestinians objected and started a demonstration on the streets of Jordan. The experience of accompanying Palestinians with great revolutionary directors had awakened the dormant dreams of Abu Ali and his friends. When the photography department team, whose main members were Mustafa Abu Ali, Hani, Johariya, and Mersal, watched the recorded images of the demonstrations, they came to the conclusion that they have everything they needed to make a movie. So they started working and made a 20-minute movie called Say No to the Peace Plan. It was the first movie of resistance organizations. The movie was screened to senior leaders of Fatah. The Palestinian leaders found something in the movie that became the main reason for their interest in cinema: the power of cinema in explaining the situation in the battlefield. The Revolution Cinema was the title Fatah leaders chose for the Palestinian cinema. Mustafa Abu Ali, in a statement, wrote for Palestine Film Foundation and highlighted the goals of the revolutionary cinema as follows. The sound of guns should be louder than any other sound. Light weapons are the people's main weapons in the war, and in the same way, light 16mm cameras are the most suitable weapon for the cinema about people. The success of a movie should be measured by the same criteria as the success of a military operation. They are both seeking to realize a political ideal.
We create a new people, and instead of being refugees, to be fighters. This is very important. We were refugees, homeless. We became now fighters, freedom fighters.
In the first step, the Palestinian cinema changed a stereotypical image of the Palestinian people. Now, after 20 years, the motivated pictures of the cinematographers replaced the image of the oppressed Palestinian refugees with that of fighting warriors. The Israelis could not put up with the Palestinians, who were now united to liberate their land. Soon enough, the conflict between Fatah and Israel began. Fatah guerrillas were the most important targets of Israel in its attacks on the Karameh village in Jordan. After Israel's rapid retreat, the battle became a legendary victory for the Palestinians, whose value doubled after the heavy defeat by the Arabs in the Six-Day War. Only in the first 48 hours after the end of the war, 5,000 Palestinians applied for membership in the organization. The Battle of Karameh initially brought about the unity of the Kingdom of Jordan and the Palestinians. But soon, the gaining of power by Fatah's guerrillas led to internal differences, and that got out of control and led to a widespread and bloody conflict. King Hussein of Jordan was targeted in an assassination attempt. the Jordanian army blamed the Palestinians. In September of 1970, King Hussein attacked the guerrillas' positions and pushed them back to the Syrian borders. Although the Fatah organization inevitably set up its organization once again in the south of Lebanon, the eventful years after exile left a deep impact on Palestinian society. Defeated by Israel and the West, disillusionment with the Arabs, the bad conditions of the refugees and displacement and isolation in Arab societies strengthened the unity of the people who were suffering from similar mental injuries. A narrative based on a common pain could act as a unifying factor. The great task was assigned to the Palestinian cinema, introducing the Palestinian national narrative instead of the failed idea of a united Arab nation. Making more than 60 documentary films was an answer to the need. It seems in these movies, all places are the same, and it's a collective situation for Palestinians. The soothing images of trees and orchards, even if they're just inside the refugee camps, they will suddenly be bombarded. The scenes of destruction and death after strikes are eventually replaced with the epic views of weapons, military training, and battle. The goal of recreating the battle scenes in these documentaries is to show a good ending to get rid of the pain of failure. By different means, the documentaries emphasize the correction of the past is made possible by referring to children or by depicting them. They are the manifestation of the future and hope against despair and disappointment of the past. In many scenes, the images of children are merged with the images of soldiers, followed by epic images of the Palestinian flag. These are the common symbols that continuously appear in Palestinian cinema and literature. They are the embodiments of hope, resurrection, and struggle. At first glance, this structure describes specific events, but since these stereotypes are repeated over and over in the form of similar scenes, it becomes something more than the recurring stereotypes. The most important achievement of the repetitive structure is the creation of a shared historical memory. The memory paints a unified picture of the Palestinian nation. As a result, geographically and socially, the divided community of refugees is united around a single memory. The memory of the United Palestinian Nation.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son. and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
A'udhu billah minash shaitani rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, who has given us multiple opportunities for self-improvement, empowerment, and perfection, one of the ways of which is becoming a parent. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. A warm salam to all of you, dear brothers and sisters, to the Imam of our time, Imam Mahdi ajalallah ta'ala farjah sharif, for whom we are raising and educating a future generation to become as part of his commanders in faith. And assalamu alaikum to the respected Sayyid in our studio, Sayyid Salman Naghawi.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So you're listening to Islamic Upbringing at IRIB English Radio. You can listen to us online at parstoday.ir. You can also refer to our social media, Instagram and Facebook, at Call of Islam Radio. And please do feel free to write to us your comments and questions if you disagree with us, if you have, you know, newer perspectives that you would like to share with us. Please write to us at our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir. Sayyid Salman Naghawi, our dear expert, is an academic board member, faculty member in Al Mustafa International University. And we've been talking a lot about the two parenting styles of transformational and transactional parenting. And we said that we always have to be educating ourselves as parents, to have logical dialogues based on hikmah, wisdom, and not merely a monologue. We talked about the importance of love, of understanding, of listening to our children. So in this program, we want to mention some practical examples so that you will have a better understanding and grasp of the idea of transformational parenting for all ears.
Yes, thank you very much. You've given a good introduction. And based on your introduction, we need to come up with some practical examples. For example, when we want to compare between transactional and transformational leadership, parenting, and we mentioned before, parenting is a culmination of two skills, educational skills and leadership skills and qualities. Because education wants... Basically, an educationist wants to bring about behavioral change, any educator, not just in the formal sense. We're not talking about education in the formal sense necessarily. It's in an informal way also. Parenting is educating people in an informal environment. People learn formally when they go to school, college, university. They learn informally in society. And the first building block of society is the family. So a parent has to be a teacher, a guide, a mentor, educationist in the informal sense. So he, and then education is for bringing about behavioral change based upon three inner things: knowledge, skills, and attitudes. Even our skills are the psychomotor skills through which we carry out many things practically, are hidden in our body. The potential, for example, if you may be a good driver, but now you're sitting here in front of me, you're not driving practically, but the skill to be able to drive has been actualized. The potential there is actualized, but your child may not be a driver. So those skills are there within you. So these knowledge, skills, and attitude coming together makes you competent to carry out behavior, good behavior for the sake of Allah. So competence and good behavior are very much intertwined. And the good behavior for an educationist is to be able to bring about behavioral change in the person who he's educating. And in this case, we're talking about our children. And a leader also wants to people to do things, the best things possible. He wants things to be done in the way that it should be carried out. He wants people to do what he likes, wants them to do, but does not impose upon them. So we said there are two styles. One is imposing, authoritative. The other is inspirational, motivational. So we come to a situation where, for example, which type is going to be appropriate, transactional or, for example, transformational? Now, let's talk about a situation. 2020s, beginning of 2020s, we had this outbreak of corona.
Mm-hmm.
People were forced to live inside their homes.
Can we go for a short break and then we'll listen to your story?
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. Sayyid Nahawi was trying to tell us, depict for us a picture from the time of the corona. Sayyid, we're all ears.
So at the time of the corona outbreak, epidemic situation that we had, now the governments were enforcing these rules and they wanted us to remain at home. We're not talking about the pros and cons. We're talking about what happened actually.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our children had to be forced. So one would say, look, transactional leadership is what's going to get the things done. If you want to give them, argue with them, and you want to
give them choice of you can do that, you cannot do that. That wasn't the case.
Yes, maybe that would be a case for transactional leadership and parenting. But even there, in that situation, if the children, especially the grown-up ones, the teenagers, the youngsters, the very small children, you need to force them to remain at home. But the teenagers, you could discuss with them
mm-hmm.
and make the decision based on their free choice.
It was so scary that you didn't even have to provide logic and reason for them. It was a matter of life and death. And
they saw
all around them, like on the news, in the radio, in their loved ones, in their kin's, relatives, whatever.
Exactly.
They saw a lot of people dying and a lot of people being
hospitalized. Themselves reasoning that but just in case there were the odd people out, the youngsters who want to say, no, what's happened? There's nothing wrong in it. So even there, you could use the transformational way of discussing and talking about the situation. And if they were not going to listen to you, then they would have to face the consequences themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They would catch the flu or whatever was there,
I think the parents' logic and dialogue with the family members could have been in the channel of providing, because fear was rampant. It was all over the place, thinking that at any time they could catch the flu and they would die, right? So, and because they had to abandon going to work, parents, they had to all be secluded in one enclosed area. This created a lot of challenges between the family members. So the role of the parents at that time, I think, was to cool down and to bring peace and to minimize the friction and the challenges between the family members, right?
Of course, there were many conspiracy theorists about rampant there also. They were saying, though, it's all been made up by the powers to be, and they, creating a new situation. I'm not talking about that, but still, there were people who would tend to look at the conspiracy theories and say, oh, it's all a hoax. It's nothing really happening. In any case, we're talking about a situation. For example, nowadays, for example, we want our children, number one, we want them to be good students. Now, sometimes we want them to become doctors because we're doctors. We wanted to be doctors. Now we want them to, no, we can't force them to become a doctor. For example, there's a religious scholar. He wants his child to become a religious scholar. We can't force it. You can't compel it. Compel him to do so, like Rahafuddin. So he has to do it out of his free choice. The thing that you can provide is the opportunity, the environment where he can develop, think independently, this thinking and this understanding that this is a choice that can be made and this is the requirements for it.
Right.
And then we have to acquire those things. I mean, especially when we're talking about, for example, when you're talking about the teenagers, we're talking about the age when they're preparing for college, university.
Right.
And then high school.
Right.
Now, in some systems of education, like in America, maybe till grade 12, it's all one comprehensive program of studies.
Right.
In other places, you have different fields starting at high school, like in Iran, in Pakistan, in other places, and even in England, you have different choices whether you'd lead to the pre-medical, go to pre-medical or pre-engineering. Now you need to give them counseling. You need to make them make the proper decision. The important thing is you need to make them good learners. In whatever field they go, the competence you want them to develop is the competence to become good students, to learn, to bring about a change in themselves, to be able to bring about change in society. They need to become reformers and leaders in whatever. That is important. Whether they become doctors, they become engineers, they become religious scholars.
Whether a carpenter.
Even a carpenter. Even whatever field.
Whatever they, field.
Even IT, whatever. They have to be leaders in that field. They have to be independent, creative people in whatever field they go. This is important, that we create productive people, we create competent people, but making them choose a path which we think it should be chosen is wrong. We give them the choices, we provide, and look at their potential, look at their aptitude, they look at what they want.
This took me to the story of the blacksmith and that alim who desired to meet with the 12th imam, and for 40 days he was trying so hard, you know, to abstain from certain things, to go to certain places with the desire and the hope and wish of meeting the 12th imam. And once he was directed to go to a bazaar where an old blacksmith was doing transactions. And he went there and he was an observer for a couple of minutes. And what did he see? He saw that an old woman came with a lock that, you know, she was needed to sell it. And she gave it to the blacksmith, and the guy said, well, this is worth this much. The lady was so surprised. She was like, well, I went to so many different blacksmiths. They offered a much lower price. He said, well, this is the exact price of what I can offer you. So when you were talking, it really doesn't matter where you are, at what position you are in the society. And then that scholar, that alim, realized that the imam of the time comes to visit him. He doesn't have to try hard for 40 days to go here and there to meet the imam. These are real leaders of the society.
Exactly.
And this brings us to the end of another episode of the program, Islamic Upbringing. Thank you very much for listening. Wa akhiru da'wana an alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio. For those who seek the truth.
Allah, 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 Allah.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن می‌کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Faith must reach the heart with prompting, repetitions, and self-abstinence. The rationalization that the mind has understood and is also necessary has not reached the heart. However, those that washed the corpses and are working with the dead from the viewpoint that this subject is repeated for them, it has reached their heart and they have no fear. It is the same with Islamic subject and subjects of the mind. They are intellectual subjects that with logical reasoning are fixed by it has no effect on the person because the result of the logical reasoning has reached the mind but has not entered the heart. There is no faith in it. The mind has understood it, but the heart has no faith in it.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. On the subject of the Islamic revolution, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, "Let us devotionally guard the Islamic revolution and in continuation of this cherished school, which is the deliverance of the oppressed and the suppression of the arrogant, let us be watchful of our carnal desires, which are the legacy of Satan." Well, here Imam Rahmatullah Alayhi is referring to one of the main benefits of the Islamic revolution, which is freedom from imperialism. Independence of people after the revolution stemmed from the fact that the former regime was fully dependent on the US and it took no decision without the Washington's information beforehand. Other countries like Britain, France, Germany were also complicit with the US in plundering the resources of Iran. Even the fabricated regime in Tel Aviv was engaged in looting the resources of the country. This was very humiliating and the nation could not tolerate it. The Islamic Revolution became a role model for other nations who seek to come out of the yoke of domineering powers and determine their affairs independently.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi, sallallahu alayhi, salli ala.
Following the great ideas of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, the current leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei hafizahullah, holds that the important point about Iran's revolution is that the efforts and threats of the enemy could not disrupt his calculation system. This is one of the important measures that the enemies adopt. When he faces you and when he knows your intentions and decisions, he tries to do something to change your calculations and to disrupt your calculation system. This is one of the important measures that the enemy adopts in various arenas. However, the enemy could not disrupt the calculation system of our magnanimous Imam, which was based on the truth of the enlightening religion of Islam. Imam Khamenei, hafazahullah, also sees independence from these arrogant powers as one of the main advantages of the Islamic revolution. Now, in the modern time, the Islamic Republic of Iran, relying on the votes of people, administers the country without foreign interference, and this has infuriated the Western colonists, especially the great Satan, the U.S. And that is how Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, talked about this issue 40 years ago, and it is quite, I think, precious. Thank you very much, and until another episode, I bid you farewell, and may Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say La ilaha
Gaza Under Attack. Welcome back to Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. I'm Saeed Pourreza. We'll get you my panel of guests in just a moment, but before that, a quick recap of some of the latest developments. A pressure cooker of despair. That's how the UN described the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where more than 1.5 million Palestinians are sheltering and are now forced to flee again ahead of a possible Israeli ground offensive. Also, another escalation. At least one Israeli soldier has been killed and 8 others injured after rockets were fired from Lebanon into the city of Safad. It came after apartheid Israel said it bombed southern Lebanon overnight. And calls for banning the Israeli regime from all global sports competitions gain momentum. European Parliament member Claire Daly signs a petition calling on sports federations worldwide to suspend the apartheid regime until it complies with international law. So far, the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on Gaza has killed at least 28,000 Palestinians and wounded some 69,000 others, with no sign of the massacre ending anytime soon. Joining me to talk about it all is Ammar Kazmi in the studio. Ammar is a legal and political analyst and worked in the parliamentary office of former Labour MP Chris Williamson. And joining him via Skype is Dr. Nahad Khanfar, a lecturer in law and politics. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. I'll start with you, Ammar. South Africa has launched an urgent request to the International Court of Justice over Israel's planned Rafah offensive. Explain what it might mean and if it has any greater chance of stopping the carnage from going ahead than the other ruling that came earlier.
Well, look, I was on an earlier program before discussing the ICJ, potential outcomes of the ICJ judgment, and I took a pretty cynical view, which was that I didn't think it was really going to amount to much. I didn't think it was going to have any material effect in stopping the genocide in Gaza. I think a few weeks now since that has happened, that has been proven to be true, because ultimately the enforcement powers of the ICJ are very limited. Ultimately, it is the job of the UN Security Council to enforce ICJ decisions and judgments. Right. And we know that the United States of America is a permanent member of the UN Security Council and can veto anything that they decide to do. Now, of course, it's very important what South Africa is doing. It's continuing to raise the issue in terms of from a legal perspective. We've seen that as a consequence, some countries like the Netherlands have desired to stop the export of certain types of weapons and parts, spare parts to Israel. And it could be the case, and it does sometimes happen, where the ICJ, after already making an order, could decide to take additional provisions and measures. But ultimately, again, it comes down to enforcement. So yes, it may potentially help to ramp up the pressure on some governments who are supporting Israel to desist from doing that.
Yes.
But in terms of literally intervening and stopping what's happening, I don't think that's what we're going to see as a result of
and
this.
And what it will probably also do is keep the Palestinian plight in the spotlight for the world to see. Dr. Chaver, the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and his war cabinet seem hell-bent on pushing forward with this plan to launch an incursion into Rafah, despite pleadings and outrage from sections of the international community. What could cause Israel to pause at this stage? Because Ammar believes that even if there is some kind of measure from the ICJ, it has to go to the UN Security Council, where the U.S. will veto it.
The Americans, the only people really can stop this, and they are the only partners they can impose serious pressure on Netanyahu. But it seems to be that Netanyahu trying all the time to preserve his position as a prime minister because he doesn't want to face consequences if this war just has an end. And it seems to be that the Americans still not really very much interested in calling for a ceasefire, simply because they wanted to give Netanyahu any kind of victory, like any picture of victory in any way or form. And it seems to be that they are counting on Netanyahu to achieve something at any point, like what happened with this ridiculous operation in releasing the two hostages, which seems to be it's being questioned really by the serious Israeli newspapers, where they are saying there is a lot of exaggeration in presenting this release, and the Americans apparently still really signing the blank check for Netanyahu just to carry out this genocidal actions all the time. So I don't see in any time, like any near time, any kind of positive response from Netanyahu.
And Amar, how do you square what we just heard and what you said earlier with the U.S. president calling Netanyahu an recently and calling what's happening in the Gaza Strip as over the top? Yet, yes, of course, we see the huge package of aid for Israel at the same time. But what is your reading into this whole thing?
Well, I mean, when it comes to Joe Biden, I would seriously question his mental faculties at the moment. But look, I mean, I think that we see very often Western politicians, particularly those in the United States, may in private have serious questions about what Israel is doing. They may in private very much oppose what Israel is doing. But ultimately, we're in a position now where I think the tail wags the dog.
Mm.
You know, people talk about Israel as being an extension of the United States. Well, actually, if you look at the amount of lobbying power that Israel has managed to influence within the United States, I think it's now really the other way around. Israel is dictating U.S. international policy. And so it doesn't really matter what they may privately think. Ultimately, they are signed up to a political system in which they are obligated, really, to support Israel. So I think that's really why we see these contradictions.
Correct. Gentlemen, stay with me. We're going to bring in what the UN chief has been saying, and then we'll get back to you shortly. Well, Antonio Guterres says an Israeli military offensive in Gaza, the southern city where some more than 1.5 million Palestinians have sought refuge, will have devastating consequences. He has told reporters that Tel Aviv has imposed restrictions that are limiting the distribution of desperately needed humanitarian aid. He said the current mechanisms for protecting humanitarian workers distributing aid in Gaza are not effective. Here is more in his own words.
I know that Prime Minister Netanyahu doesn't take your phone calls. You have not been able to speak to him despite your best efforts. We know that he is preparing potentially for a ground invasion to Rafah. If you could speak to Prime Minister Netanyahu today, what would be your message?
Well, I am particularly worried with the deteriorating conditions and security for humanitarian aid delivery in Gaza. There is a breakdown in public order. At the same time, we have restrictions imposed by Israel that are not improving and limit humanitarian distribution. On the other hand, the deconflicting mechanisms to protect humanitarian aid delivery in relation to military operations are not effective. And so my sincere hope is that the negotiations for the release of hostages and some form of cessation of hostilities to be successful, to avoid a all-out offensive over Rafah, where the core of the humanitarian system is located, and that would have devastating consequences. Thank you very much.
Two more journalists were targeted.
The UN Secretary General speaking there. Dr. Khafer, as we know, the UN Chief and the Israeli Prime Minister have a fractious relationship, with Tel Aviv succeeding to a degree in sidelining the global body altogether. How does the aid agency get around this? People are dying all around as we speak.
As a matter of fact, it is something about like can be described just really horrific. I mean, what we get from the ground, just I was talking to some colleagues earlier, which they have some connection to Gaza, especially to the humanitarian aids. They are really giving a very terrifying picture, because the situation on the ground, especially when it comes to the food, to the medical basic needs, is just very, very restricted, and the people hardly getting really what they can eat on daily basis. Many of the people, they can't really get any kind of food portions on daily basis. So sometimes they eat one day, they might not find food for the next day. The organization is just trying their best to, you know, just to really work around these kind of restrictions. And it seems to be the Israeli government is really just pushing all their plans forward in order to starve the people and, you know, just to put more or to mount more pressure on the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, because it seems to be this is the only way probably to you know, to achieve some compromises from the Palestinian resistance in the negotiations. So situation is becoming, you know, very difficult, and it seems to be the Israel is just really challenging all the world, and no exception, whether the United Nations, whether the European countries. We have heard yesterday what Borrell was saying. He was clearly devastated. Yeah. So there is no attention whatsoever to any call, any announcement, any condemnation from the international community. So Israel is just really positioning itself to be above anyone, above everyone, above any kind of action.
There's some movements in some quarters in Europe, of course. You mentioned Europe there, Amar, and that's what I want to talk to you about. We know Israel is blocking aid in contravention of the ICJ ruling. As I said at the beginning of the show, at the top, that there have been rockets fired into northern Zionist entity, killing one soldier, injuring a number of others. And at the same time, the independent bloc members of the European parliamentarians are pushing for the full pariah treatment for Israel, including being banned from international events. We've seen it done to South Africa in the last century and to Russia in recent years. What do you make of that route?
Well, look, I think the EU, we have to be very careful because it's not a homogenous bloc. We talk about the European Union, but there are different powers vying for authority in there. You have Germany, which is obviously very fanatically pro-Israel. But then you have other member states like Spain, Ireland, France to a lesser degree, who have either opposed Israel right from the very beginning or have taken or have sort of grown impatient with the scale of the offensive.
And the French have slapped sanctions on some of the settlers too.
100%. And actually the United Kingdom is also planning to do something similar. So, you know, but I think clearly the mood is turning. We saw the EU foreign policy chief, which we just mentioned, Josep Borrell, who has said some pretty wild things. In general, is quite a, in my view, quite a pro-colonial man, quite a racist person. Now coming out and saying these really incredible statements about Israel and saying that if you want to stop Israel committing its offensive, then you have to stop supplying them with arms. So I think that there is a mood turning, not just among sort of, you know, independent parliamentarians, but actually across some very senior levels of member states of the European Union. And so I think we could get to a position, particularly if Israel did launch a full-scale attack on Rafah and it really, really got out of hand, much more than it already has, where, you know, we could
is
get
to... Is that really what it takes? And not 30,000 Palestinians already killed?
Well,
does
I mean,
it have to really be that red line to be crossed by the Israeli regime for these countries to finally come out and say enough is enough?
Well, I mean, it's clear that there's a huge contradiction between how people's lives are viewed. We saw with Ukraine, a white European country, when that was, when Russia launched its operation against Ukraine, there were sanctions slapped on Russia straight away. It was made into an international pariah state, a huge increase in Russophobia even among ordinary Russians in Europe. But when Israel does this, we don't get the same treatment. But I do think that if it gets to an even more serious point, that I think is probably what it will have to take, unfortunately, in Europe for the mood to change substantially.
Okay. Now, Dr. Khanfer, do you think also that on the question of what might make Israel think twice about launching that massive incursion into Rafah, the rockets that have been fired into northern Israel from southern Lebanon, although Hezbollah, the resistance movement, the group in Lebanon, has not claimed responsibility, but there have been rockets fired. One Israeli soldier killed, a number of them injured. Do you think that is why the message from the Lebanese to the Israelis, look, if you go ahead with this, then we're going to hurt you?
Yeah, I think this was very obvious from the speech delivered by Hezbollah leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. He actually made a very clear connection between the escalation in Gaza and what's happening in North Lebanon, so in South Lebanon. So by the end of the day, it seems to be the message is very clear, and I don't think we can really raise too many questions about it, whether it is connected or not connected. It seems to be very much connected, and the Hebrew newspapers today, I was looking into some of them published in Hebrew. They were very much talking about the speech delivered by Hassan Nasrallah yesterday, and they gave it really a very, very high level of a credit and a credibility that if the situation in Gaza is gonna to be solved sometime soon, then we would expect a ceasefire also in Lebanon or from the Lebanese side. So yes, the connection is there, and I don't think the Hezbollah is playing games here, because in the previous truce, this exactly what happened. It was for almost 1 week, and the truce started in Lebanon or from Lebanese
Correct.
Side.
Correct.
So so the kind of a pressure we can imagine is there, and I think it might be escalating as far as the Israelis are escalating their military operations in Gaza.
It's all a matter of time, of course. Just a quick reminder before we move on.